Welcome to Top Advisor Marketing, where you will learn how to become a prolific online influencer, attract more ideal clients, and grow your practice. Brought to you by Top Advisor Podcasting, a done-for-you podcasting solution built just for trusted advisors. And now, your co-hosts of Top Advisor Marketing, Kirk Lowe and Matt Halloran.
Hello and welcome to another Top Advisor Marketing Podcast. This is kind of a big deal for us at Top Advisor Marketing because we finally hit our 100th episode. And with that 100th episode, we wanted to get somebody on who was, you know, kind of a big deal, as big of a deal as us hitting 100 podcasts. And I've been trying to get Michael on the podcast now for a while, and we just have not been able to coordinate it because of his travel schedule and the fact that he has his own podcast. And I'm sure all of you out there have read his blog. But our guest today is Michael Kitsis, publisher of the Nerd's Eye View on Kitsis.com, co-founder of the XY Planning Network and Advice Pay, and partner and director of wealth management for the Pinnacle Advisory Group. Michael, thanks for being on the show, man.
It's good to be here. I'm glad we finally figured out how to schedule this. Entirely my fault for my terrible travel schedule, but here we are. We finally made it work.
And
we get to talk advisor marketing.
Yeah, you're such a sought after person. And I think I want to kind of start there, Michael, if you don't mind, because I remember when you kind of hit the scene, right? Because you said it was, how long ago was it when you really first started to blog?
It kind of went in two stages. I initially launched, sort of went out on my own from the advisory firm, launched my newsletter service and started doing speaking in 2008.
Okay.
I launched a blog attached to it. You know, I was writing my newsletter on dense technical advanced planning topics. The blog was going to be for short hit things that didn't merit being in our full newsletter. I published it for a couple of months. I felt like no one was reading it. I installed Google Analytics. I proved no one was reading it. and I just shut it down. I was like, I don't get this whole blogging thing. Mm-hmm. And then I came back to it in 2010. So I was at a study group meeting in the summer of 2010. And I'm in a study group with a guy named Bill Winterberg, who does a lot of advisor tech consulting, kind of advisor tech guru guy. So, you know, Bill's where I go to get my, you know, what's cutting edge in advisor technology. And so Bill was telling me, you should check out this platform that's come out. It's called Twitter, and I think you'd really like it. Mm-hmm. And so I joined Twitter, and I started following some people. I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, I would find people that had these interesting specializations and would just share a lot of stuff in that area and really liked it. So I followed some people in finance and I followed some publications I thought were interesting. And it basically started becoming my own personal news feed. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I had this proverbial light bulb above head moment, mm-hmm. Eureka, I see it, that for people that were creating content, the social media was their distribution, it was how someone that created cool stuff got it to people like me who wanted to read cool stuff. Mm-hmm. I said, wait a minute, I think I make some cool stuff. I want people to read it. I already proved that no one reads it when I just post it to my blog, because mm-hmm. no one knows what the heck that is. Social media is the key to getting it out there. This is how you distribute this stuff. And so I relaunched the blog in the fall of 2010 with a commitment that I was immersing myself into social media to go with it. I'm going to make the content and I'm going to use social media to distribute it. And basically that's when it took off. Mm-hmm. And that's when it got going. And so technically there are blog posts from back in 2008 when I did the initial launch. But as I view it, the blog's really gone in earnest since the fall of 2010. So we're about 8 years out now of just having it grow and compound. And basically it's roughly doubled every year for about 8 years. Hmm. So, the first year that meant 17 people showed up a day, most of which were still my friends and family and my mom.
Yeah.
But then the next year it was 30 to 50 a day, mm-hmm. and then it was 100 a day, and then it was 200, and then it was 400, and then it was 800, and it mm-hmm. just kept compounding. Mm-hmm. And we see the same thing in what we always tell our clients about investing. How do you save $1 million for retirement? The answer is $10 a day for 30 years, mm-hmm. and $10 a day feels like a minuscule contribution towards a million, but 30 years of compounding and you get there.
Right.
And, you know, it's the same sort of thing with the blog. And I really, I guess the truth is that that's how almost all marketing applies, that like there's not much out there that's a quick hit. If there was, you know, someone else would have thrown all the money at it and made it work until it was dead anyways.
Right.
You know, what works is just steady, persistent effort that compounds over time. And, you know, we're 8 years into the compounding now, and this stuff really adds up after
yeah, it really
years
does.
Of compounding.
Well, you know,
it's
Michael, you just really hit the nail on the head there. And I think that if anybody is trying to sell you that quick fix, you need to run away, because it's not, there is no marketing quick fix. You've been doing, you know, when people look at you now, right? Like, oh my God, Michael's a master marketer. And you really are. When it comes to what works, you are firing on all cylinders, right? With all of the things that you're involved in, with the blog, with your podcast, with your speaking, with all of the stuff that you've got going on, you have really truly mastered it and are achieving really fantastic success from it. But it wasn't overnight. You have put an enormous amount of blood, sweat, and tears in this, and frequent flyer miles, I'm assuming. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yeah. Between all the different conference speaking I do, I probably fly 150,000 miles a year, like button seat miles. You know, the all the fancy multipliers you get means I have a bajillion airline miles that sadly accumulate. Like the irony for like pretty hardcore travelers like me is the last thing you want to do with your free time is go back to an airport when you're already there several days a week, every week. So when I actually get home, I don't want to go and use my miles. So they just accumulate. So I at some point I figure out how to do something with them, but it's a lot of miles and a lot of flying and just a lot of writing and a lot of articles. You know, we've done, well, it's varied a little bit on frequency. We did three a week for a while. We did two a week for a while. We did daily content. Then we went back to three days a week. And now we've been doing daily content again for probably 4 years now.
How did you find your voice, Michael? You had, when we were joking and preparing for the podcast that you had talked about, that those early blogs that you had written were nowhere near where they are today, because it did take you time to find your voice. How did you find it? Was it just, you know, stepping back up to the plate and swinging, or did you get a writing coach? Did you help me with that?
So I never went the route of a writing coach or anything. You know, I at least had, I guess, a little bit of a natural gift that just, I'm one of those people that can read through things and just say, oh, that's not written right. Like that grammar's not right. Those words aren't right. Like I'm the person who reads books and finds the typos that the editor missed. Like I just see them. Okay. So like I didn't really need a writing coach on the just kind of clean up the grammar and the writing stuff. You're just finding a voice and a style took me a while. So part of it was just kind of the iteration of doing it. You know, the nice thing when you launch a blog is hardly anyone reads it, which means if you're not really that good at it yet, hardly anyone reads it. So you got some room here. Mm-hmm. So someone was doing and looking at just what was working, what was resonating. The thing I love about like blogging and the digital world in particular, you can measure everything. Oh, I mean, yeah. Google Analytics sometimes are a little bit creepy about how much you can measure, but you can measure everything. So it didn't take me long to start doing this and just looking back and saying like, well, that topic resonated really well, or well, that one went horribly. Like hardly anyone clicked on it. The people that did had almost no time on site. The bounce rate was high. Like there's a whole bunch of metrics that you can measure to see if people are engaging with the content and doing something with it. And so part of it was just the natural feedback mechanism, like, oh, I did that and it worked. I think I'm going to do that more.
Yes.
And just iterate on what works and leave behind what doesn't work. Part of it was, you know, the truth, I think, is most of us have a voice in how we write, how we speak, what we do. The challenge for us as advisors in particular, I think, is we spend the overwhelming majority of time proactively trying to filter out our own voice. because we do it under the auspices of like, well, anything that someone asks, the answer is it depends. And I have to always be neutral, middle of the road. Mm-hmm. And like, I can't say anything that's controversial about religion or politics or sex or even money, because I might offend someone along the way. And so if you work really hard at making sure that everything you say will never possibly offend anyone, there's no voice left.
Yeah.
Like, you have scrubbed out anything that's possibly interesting. You're basically just producing kind of bland, trite, middle of the road advice that isn't even much advice, because it usually has absolutely no specificity, because you're trying as hard as you can to say it depends is the answer to everything.
Right.
And so just lifting some of those filters and constraints from yourself, your voice comes through pretty quickly. Like, the biggest thing I had to get comfortable with was not finding my voice. It was just recognizing that almost anything any of us says with our own voice, you're going to piss someone off.
Yeah.
Got to be okay with that.
Yeah. Interesting. We do have, like, our best podcast clients and our best people who blog, they have found that. They have come to terms with that. But so many people, Michael, as you know better than anybody, have been so punished by compliance departments, by whatever. Do you help people with that? I mean, when you're speaking and when you, a lot of people listen to you, man. So how do you help empower financial services professionals to get out of their own way when it comes to that?
So there's a few options to this, and some of it does depend on where you are and kind of the environment you're in. You know, I do think it's more challenging in the broker-dealer environment. That's just a reality. And the larger the broker-dealer, basically the worse it is.
Right.
And that's not meant to be a bash against broker-dealers at all. It's just, it's the reality of what happens when you try to apply compliance in a large firm environment that has low hiring standards.
Right. Which
unfortunately is the BD world, right? Like, I can get a license to give someone recommendations about their life savings and how to invest it with a high school diploma and a 3-hour regulatory exam, and the diploma is actually optional.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's all it takes. One little series exam, and I can take someone's life savings and invest it in something that may or may not turn out well. So if you imagine a compliance person for a moment that says, say, okay, there are 1,000 advisors at this firm, and if one of them, whoever the one biggest idiot is that we somehow managed to hire, if that one giant idiot does something that gets us fined by FINRA, you're fired.
Yep.
Now, make some compliance rules. So what ends up happening? If you as a compliance officer don't want to get fired, you make the rule that will restrain the one biggest idiot in the entire organization from bringing you down or getting you fined and fired. Which means the other 999 competent advisors get dragged down to the lowest common denominator.
Yep.
And unfortunately, when your hiring standards are pretty low, the lowest common denominator is really low.
It's really low. Yeah.
And so we end up with incredibly painfully restrictive compliance environments. You know, when you flip over to the RIA side of the channel, of the industry channels, you tend to see a whole lot more flexibility. And it's not because RA rules are more flexible around social media and advertising. In fact, technically, like, the stakes and the rules are even higher.
Oh, totally.
Literally your advertising is held to a fiduciary duty. That's actually the origin of the fiduciary duty for registered investment advisors. It was an anti-fraudulent marketing provision that turned into a fiduciary duty. So the standards are really high and stringent, but when you get into that environment in an independent RIA, you know, it's like, it's me and my partner and a couple of staff. So I go to my partner, who's the chief compliance officer, and say, hey, we own this business 50-50 and have our entire lives at stake. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to try to not do anything that completely screws up our business. And I'd appreciate if you would not do anything that completely screws up our business. And we both say, okay. And then we move on because we already trust each other and we know each other's competency. And so while you still have to check the appropriate boxes on compliance, the process tends to be easier because I can make normal processes that apply to intelligent human beings and I don't have to make lowest common denominator compliance rules instead. So I do see a lot of firms that, you know, I see a lot of advisors that have migrated to the RIA channels just for that flexibility of retaining a little bit more control over their marketing and their voice and their and their message. But I've seen plenty of people do it successfully in the broker-dealer channels as well. You know, the ones that do it successfully, I find, have a couple of common traits. The first is, frankly, they tend to spend a lot of time doing marketing that is like covering topics that are not traditional finance. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is, like, you're not going to outdo MarketWatch, CNBC, and Kiplinger and the rest on, like, you know, they have 7 great tips of why you should open a Roth IRA. So you're going to write an article about 8 great tips and you're going to zing them all on the 8th. Like, no one clicks on that. No one's going to read that. You're not going to outdo the marketing and reach that those publications already have. You will never beat them on SEO, search engine optimization. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a wasted effort to try. And so a lot of folks I see that are most successful, they go completely different directions. Like, you want to work with small business owners, don't write about small business owner tax strategies. Write about leadership. Mm-hmm. And small business owners who are struggling to evolve to higher levels of leadership are going to be attracted to that content. And guess what? If they go to you for all their content and trust your expertise, mm-hmm. when they've got a financial question, they might call you.
Yeah.
And if you start writing articles about leadership, compliance doesn't have a lot to say.
Nope.
You're not writing about investments. You're not writing about tax law. You're not writing about basically anything that they can get sued by. You're writing about things that aren't within the normal purview of compliance and actually happen to matter more to your target audience anyways. While you still have to go through and get those reviewed by compliance, you're going to find that they get reviewed and approved relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And if they don't early on, after you've done 3 or 5 or 10 or 15,
they're good.
And the compliance officer eventually realizes that every time they read your stuff, it has nothing to do with anything that they care about for compliance purposes. Mm-hmm. It starts going through a little bit easier, at least at most broker dealers.
You know,
so that's part of how you navigate it at the end of the day. Like, just you don't have to write about the stuff, the most highly regulated parts of our industry. And in fact, most of us, if we want to differentiate and reach our target clientele, would be better off not writing about that stuff, because it's the same stuff everybody else writes about and podcasts about and talks about. And it's so brutally hard to differentiate or even just get attention in that space over much larger publications that will trump you anyways.
You know, when you're working in, there's so much of what you just said there. I'm going to try to break down a couple of those different things from a marketing standpoint. You're really talking about differentiating yourself, which is obviously the key and what you have done so successfully, number one. Number two, people, if they do want investment advice, they are going to go to the big names, right? You're probably not going to come out with something that's so fundamentally unique and different that they're going to click on your article over, you know, paid news things, Market Watch, Forbes, blah, 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 blah.
Even just good luck getting in front of them.
Right.
Like, I mean, you know, 12 million people follow CNBC. How many are going to follow your Twitter channel? Like,
not 12 million.
When CNBC publishes something, it goes out to Google News and Flipboard and Zeit and all of those. Mm-hmm. Your stuff ain't showing up there. Like, just you don't have the distribution reach to compete on traditional content.
But the non-traditional content, and so what we have found, we also, you were talking about Google Analytics and how you can find out anything about anything, and it's even creepy
with
our internal marketing person who we just had on a podcast recently, Kaylee was talking about how really detailed we can get. But what we have found is when you post something that is non-financially related, and we talk about this all the time, it actually pleases the algorithm more because you're not just reproducing the same crap that everybody else is talking about. You're talking about something personal, which creates a conversation, which Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter all like a whole bunch. Now you have carved out a magnificent niche with this, but when you're talking to other financial advisors, when they're listening to your podcast, when they're reading the blog, you're driving home that same point, Michael, that we're driving home. Why are advisors so resistant to share things about themselves personally in order for people to make that human connection? Because it's just like the small business owners, brother, just like what you were just talking about. I'm going to write about leadership because I want to get in front of leaders. Well, that's very, very different than writing about another flipping tax strategy.
Yep. I think it's twofold. One, you know, we get hesitant to write about and communicate about ourselves because we're afraid we're going to say something that someone won't like and it's going to piss someone off, right? Just it's much easier to travel the middle of the road if you don't divulge personal stuff. And I think part of it is just a sheer vulnerability thing, right? Just sharing stuff about you personally, it makes you vulnerable at some level. And you know, it doesn't get any easier when you're like, hey, now I'm only going to share something vulnerable about myself. I'm going to share something vulnerable about myself on the internet where things never die.
Well,
right?
I think it
freaks people out sometimes. But at the same time, like, you know, if there's one thing that we seem to be taking away from the whole bent of kind of leadership around research for the past 10 years, it's all about authenticity and leadership. Right. And authenticity starts with, you know, being a real human being that shows up as a human being, including making yourself vulnerable from time to time. And that's a big part of what leadership looks like in practice. And, you know, I view an aspect of marketing at the end of the day, like you're trying to build a community around you of people that like what you like and believe in what you believe in and therefore want to work with you. And that means you kind of have a little mini leadership responsibility for the community of people you're trying to build that you may do business with someday. Mm-hmm. And so you have to make yourself a little vulnerable at some point. But I mean, from their end, like, people don't look and say, hey, I don't like that guy or gal because I don't think they make themselves vulnerable enough. Like, that's not how we connect to it. It's just that, you know, we all have personal struggles. And it's not often that we get to share and relate them.
Well, there's a great speaker who you've probably been on the same circuit as he is. His name is Dr. Robert Cialdini, and he talks about the principles of ethical influence. Mm-hmm. And that level of vulnerability, he has proven through all sorts of blind studies and scientific method that is actually the fastest way to build trust with an audience. You know, showing that you're human, that you have warts, makes people want to trust you even faster, because then you are coming across as somebody who is just like them. Because as we all know, people want to do business with people they like, trust, and have things in common with. Now, I'm going to break down the three different businesses that you have going on here, because I personally want to know a little bit more. And I don't know, Michael, how often you are on the other side of the mic, dude. Like, I know you speak and I know that you interview people on podcasts, but I don't know how often your people get to probe you. So I'm going to do that as appropriately as possible. So Nerd's Eye View, let's talk about that very quickly. Tell us, where in God's name did that come from? I'm sure everybody who's listening to this podcast subscribes to your blog. I mean, talk about vulnerability. You're using a pejorative word, right?
Yeah.
That has totally become part of your brand in a really positive way. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So the first 8 years or so of my career, like, I was in the usual advisor world. I started out as a life insurance agent, terrible at prospecting, went over to the broker dealer side, landed in RIA, didn't understand anything about the industry channels at the time. Like, I was just switching firms and trying to find something that would work for me, as many of us do early in our careers. You know, landed, frankly, with dumb luck at what turned out to be a very well-positioned, rapidly growing RIA that was early to the wealth management AUM model and movement. And, you know, had some great growth with the firm and some great personal career growth, and just got to a point in by about 2008 where I just had an itch to do more writing and more speaking. You know, I enjoyed the work that we did for our clients, but just, I don't know, for me, there was an itch to scratch of having a broader reach and impact than just what we were doing internally for our clients. And so I made a transition in early 2008, you know, totally oblivious to what was coming later that year.
Good timing, brother. Good timing.
Yeah, good timing, right? Great, perfect time to launch a business and go independent. I launched this speaking and newsletter business. So I was already doing a little bit of speaking. I was already, like, writing some articles for trade publications, Journal of Financial Planning, Financial Planning Magazine, Investment Advisor, those sorts of publications. And I was actually getting really aggravated because back in the 2000s, most publications, like, the internet had been around for a while. Most publications were both print and online, but most publications were print first, online second.
Yeah, I remember when those magazines were. Yeah, totally.
And so what that meant from a very practical perspective as someone that was, like, writing stuff was I would write this article in, you know, Microsoft Word, where there's no space limitations. Mm-hmm. And then I would send it off to a publication. They would say, hey, this looks great, but we're going to chop your article by 40% because we have to fit this seven inches of column space.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to publish it online later. I'm like, but there's no space limit online. Like, you just keep hitting page down. This is not hard.
Right.
Why do you have to cut all my stuff for print first? I was getting really aggravated by being cut because I felt like I tend to go deep in what I do. And when my stuff got cut, I feel like you took a unique article where I shared some deeper insights that you can't get anywhere else, and then you chopped it into a short, bland article that sounds like everything else. Like, mm-hmm. you're taking all the special stuff and deleting it so that you can fit into a limited page, column space that is unnecessary because we have computers now.
Right.
So I said, forget it then. I'm going to make my own newsletter. It's only going to be digital PDF, mm-hmm. so I can make it long and you don't have to cut for the column space. We'll just print more pages on the end of the PDF.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this vision that I was going to launch this newsletter. You know, like, I viewed it akin to Bob Viris's Inside Information, which I know a lot of folks out there read.
Totally.
Fantastic publication on practice management. So my vision back in 2008 was I wanted to write about technical stuff the way that Bob wrote about practice management.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to do a monthly newsletter. I was charging $150 a year. Every month was going to be one like deep dive into a technical topic for those other folks that like to nerd out on planning strategies like I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was doing a little bit of speaking, and I sort of had this grand vision, like speaking would promote the newsletter and then the newsletter would promote speaking, and I could have this virtual circle of my business growing. And then I kept one foot in the advisory firm. I didn't want to completely walk away from clients I interacted with over the years and stuff I was doing there, and I still felt like I had something to contribute back to the firm. So it was sort of one foot in the firm, one foot outside doing this newsletter and speaking spiral thing, just so I could publish stuff that would not get cut for print publication space constraints. That mm-hmm. was like the driver for it at the end of the day.
Hmm.
And it worked. It started compounding. As I said earlier, in 2010, I launched the blog with sort of this commitment to social media. And the blog is what really actually took off and made the whole thing work. You know, mm-hmm. the nice thing about a newsletter business is, you know, I was selling subscriptions for $150 a year. So you mm-hmm. get paid for it. You sell right. enough of those. Eventually, all you got to do is spend a couple hours a month writing a newsletter a month, and a whole bunch of money shows up every year because it's a recurring subscription model.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice model, and it's very leverageable, but you still have to get the word out because no one knows they're going to like the newsletter until they read the newsletter, except you don't give them the newsletter until they pay for the newsletter. So like it's a marketing challenge.
Sure.
And it's hard because it's a marketing challenge for an intangible information product, which mm-hmm. is hard to sell. When I started doing the blog, you know, that content's just out there. You can find it for free. You can share it. If you like it, your friends will share it with other people. If someone Googles for it, eventually they may find their way to it. And the blog content started growing and compounding. And what happened within about 2 or 3 years was the blog was so out compounding everything else and growing that it grew this huge readership. The readership started really launching my speaking business much mm-hmm. faster than the newsletter business because it got me a lot of visibility. And the more that the blog grew, the more I really just focused in on the blog.
Mm.
And so, you know, now like I kind of joke, but from a functional perspective, in essence, like I give away about 99% of the content that we create now
mm-hmm.
because I get paid so well for the last 1%.
That's right.
Which is people who hire me to speak, clients who read this stuff and decide to hire our advisory firm to work with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. Like, you know, we write really long form content. I mean, we put daily articles out and they're many pages long. And, you know, I often kind of get question, sort of half joking, half serious, like, does any consumer actually read this? And the answer is almost no one because they're really long.
But,
you know who does read it?
Mm-hmm.
People with a lot of money and complex problems.
Right.
Because they have so much at stake,
mm-hmm.
they have to figure this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Those are also known as good clients who have a lot of money and are motivated for help.
Totally.
This is a good market.
So with that,
and so we've grown a lot of business back to the advisory firm, even though I sort of write for advisors first, just because that was where my focus mm-hmm. and passion was in launching the blog. We generate a lot of client business off of these nerdy long form articles because not everyone wants to read them. Just people with money and complex problems who happen to be really good prospects.
And so that is the Pinnacle Advisory Group.
And so that's Pinnacle Advisory Group.
Okay. And so with that, I'm really curious, how many clients do you have and how can you manage those clients with all of this other stuff, dude?
So I don't keep a personal client base at this point. Okay. That was one of the transitions I had to make a couple of years ago. Okay. So, you know, lots of client inquiries come into the site and, you know, we would love to work
there
with you.
There you go. Beautiful.
Met Jeff.
Yeah, sure.
Jake, like I, yeah, well, the nice thing for our firm, you know, we're a little over $2 billion under management now. We've got 8 partners around the table and 15, 16 advisors now in total. So lots of great advisors at the firm that clients can work with. You know, we've even got the flexibility of, you know, hey, I think you're a really good fit for my partner, Jake, but, you know, sit down with him, spend a little time. Sure. If that's not a good fit, like we have a number of other really good advisors at the firm. So I will work with you and make sure that you find the right advisor to help you at our firm, parentheses, but it's not going to be me because sure. I just don't have the time and capacity. Gotcha. So there's still a subsidy. You know, I'm now 15 plus years at the firm. So there's a lot of clients I've worked with over the years that I still need to show up at least once a year to a client meeting and help support the relationship. So I'm not completely removed from the client side, but I'm just not taking on clients directly. I wouldn't have the capacity to serve them to my own standards about how I think clients should be served. It's one of the transitions that I think anybody that's really wired as an entrepreneur and a business builder has to decide to make at some point. Like as proud as I think I am about the good advisory work that I can do with clients, my highest and best use is not serving our clients directly, because you can only serve so many of them in your capacity.
Right.
My highest and best use is growing the business for everybody that we can serve.
And you said at the beginning of the podcast that you weren't a very good prospector at the beginning. And now look what you have truly now not become a prospector. You have become a master marketer. Now let's talk about the XY Planning Network. Now you talked about Bill Winterberg, right?
Yep.
And Alan Moore is another name that I always see attached to that. So let's talk about XY and AdvicePay, please.
So XY Planning Network is turnkey financial planning platform for helping advisors that want to serve next generation clients. So Gen X and Gen Y clients, where the whole industry said for a long time, like you can't serve those clients profitably if you're not doing portfolios or selling them products. Like just they can't pay enough to make a good living. And you know, basically we made XY Planning Network to prove them all wrong and show that you can. That's what I tend to do with businesses. So our focus for XY Planning Network in particular is helping advisors get paid to serve next generation clients using what we call a monthly retainer model or a monthly subscription model. So you envision almost everybody in the working world today, we live our lives on a monthly basis. We get paid once or twice a month. All our bills come due once a month.
Yep.
Every service I buy now is a monthly subscription fee service. So we structure financial planning the same way. It's very comfortable for young clients. It's how they're used to paying for everything else. It's frankly just literally easier to cash flow because they don't have to write a big check up front. You just write an ongoing monthly fee. And so the math of it becomes pretty simple at the end of the day. You know, if you're going to charge your client, say, $150 a month, it's $1,800 a year. Most advisors can serve up to about 100 clients and they get full. 100 clients a year at $1,800 a year is $180,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Our XY Planning Network membership fee is $5,000 a year. For $5,000, we give you compliance consulting and all the backend stuff you need. We give you all the technology you need to run your firm. So we give you financial planning software. We give you a CRM system. We give you a billing system because you got to actually have software to bill your clients on a monthly basis. So all the tools that you need to run your practice. You may have a little bit of other overhead as well, but you know, lean, efficient solo firms can take home 80 to 90% or more of all of their revenue after expenses. So you might gross 180 and net more than 150.
Yeah.
Working with young people.
Yeah.
And making pretty good money. Now I know there are advisors out there who make a much bigger number. And, you know, if you want to work with more affluent young people, you can move that number up. We have some advisors in our network that are working in, you know, particular like high net worth young clients or just high income young clients. I specialize in young doctors who are making mm-hmm. $300,000 a year or more. You can charge those folks $10,000 a year.
Sure.
Now all of a sudden, like, hey, you know, cut the client loan in half. You serve 50 great clients, mm-hmm. $10,000 a year, $500,000 of revenue. Maybe you'll hire an assistant just to help out. You'll right. net $350,000 to $400,000 a year right. working with young clients, charging only fees, netting $400,000.
Yeah.
Pretty good business. Yeah. And so XY Planning Network is built to help advisors do that model successfully. So we help them do their RIA registration and set up the RIA entity and provide them a lot of consulting support on all the just compliance things you got to do year round. Because if you're going to get paid fees, you got to be an RIA. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be an RIA on your own, like, helps to have some compliance support. We give them all the technology that they need in order to run the firm, all the core stuff that they need. You know, you can buy some additional technology and we get some discounts for some of those tools. But we give you all the core stuff that you need. And then it's just a whole community of other advisors that do the same thing. So we've got about 725 advisors in the network now. So if you know, think of us as kind of a compare to other broker dealers, we're roughly the size of a top 30 broker dealer. Mm-hmm. But we don't run the broker dealer model where it's all about products and getting a percentage of your revenue. Right. We just charge a flat fee for the services that we provide and you go grow the business as big as you want to grow the business.
You know, I love that you say that. I remember talking to Alan Moore many, many, many years ago. And one of the things that he had said to me about, we were just getting to know each other because he kind of hit the stage and I reached out to him through social media because I noticed that he was, you know, really very apparent, like he became somebody to follow. And I called him and he said, you know, Matt, for me and what I want to be able to build, it really has to do with quality of life. And I yep. think that, you know, the days now, this is a personal opinion and I'm right on the cusp of when this consciousness shift has happened. But, you know, the days of being tied to a desk 70, 80 hours a week, you know, where you wear that as a badge of honor, I think that especially, you know, later generation X, Y, and of course, millennials specifically, that is not a badge of honor. That's actually a very negative yep. aspect. And I love that. And you address that in X, Y. And I've seen some of your yep. pieces about work-life balance. And I personally want to thank you all for doing that, because I was just having a conversation with an advisor today and her father is old. I mean, like really, really, really old, but he can't let go because so much yeah. of his identity has been wrapped up. What's happening is since he can't let go and he's having health issues, he has to have a fire sale, Michael, on his practice, which is great for somebody like us, right? A younger person who is entrepreneurial, but it's terrible for him because the equity and all of the sweat that he put in for so many years isn't there. Now, in closing today, what's next for you, man? You kind of conquered some stuff here. What is the next big mountain that you're going to try to climb?
Oh, man, it doesn't really end for us. Like we, you know, the interesting effect that we've gotten from the platform now is just having such a broad readership and such a good relationship with them that, you know, between just people that leave comments on the blog, people that write me directly, all the folks I get to talk to when I'm out at conferences speaking, like, I just get a never-ending discussion of everything that advisors are doing and where all the challenges are. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of leads to this never-ending series of businesses, frankly, that we keep creating. So, you know, after XY Planning Network, we made Advice Pay because, mm-hmm. you know, this whole shift towards advisors getting paid fees for their advice, like there's no software to bill fees. I mean, if you're also managing an investment account, that's fine. We just bill the investment account. Right. But if clients actually need to pay you from a bank account or a credit card, not because they have debt, but just because they want the credit card points, like we have no billing system for right. it. So we made Advice Pay to solve that problem. Hmm. You know, the latest venture that we spun up is a business called FP Pathfinder, and it produces flow charts and checklists. Hmm. You know, lots that's been written in other industries, you know, checklists are a staple for pilots in the airline industry. They become a staple in the medical industry with huge improvements in patient outcomes. There's no checklists and flowcharts for in the advisor world. Lots of folks I know that say they want some and would love to make some, but they don't have time to make them. So we said we're going to make them and then we'll make them available to all advisors. Mm-hmm. So we launched that business earlier this year and already have hundreds of advisors that have signed up and are using all the flow charts that we're making. We release several more every month on a cool. never-ending cycle. and you know, just trying to solve the problems that we see for the advisor community. And the piece that we're actually working on right now is launching a research business specifically to go deeper into what do advisors really do and where are our challenges really. Because I, you know, with much respect to some of the other industry research firms out there, I find a lot of them either they're super broad, you know, they're looking at the whole industry in the aggregate, where financial advisor is a label that's used for hundreds of thousands of people, many of whom really don't do anything that resembles advice. It's really just selling a particular product. And most of the rest of the research is really just around practice management benchmarking, which I think is great and an incredibly important thing. But there's all these gaps to me about what we do, you know, from we're going to do a study next year on actually advisor marketing, because while we all talk about advisor marketing, the challenge of advisor marketing, there's almost no research out there about like what do people actually do? What works? Like empirically, if we study thousands of advisors, like what works? Where do they spend? How many advisors still grow their businesses with seminar marketing versus digital and blogging versus doing Facebook ads versus just COI marketing versus just getting referrals from their existing clients and not doing any of the rest? Like the average advisor spends about 2% of their revenue on marketing. Of the firms that spend 5% of revenue, do they actually grow faster or is it just wasteful money? Like these are questions I have as, frankly, a business owner myself, as someone that follows the space. No one's researching it well, so we're going to do that. The study that we actually just launched and will be coming out very soon this fall is specifically on the financial planning process. You know, advisors have long said it's hard to do financial planning because it's so time consuming. We had the question, like, which part exactly is time consuming? Like, what is it? Like, is it just the software takes a long time to load? Is it all the client meetings you have to do? Is it the data gathering process? Are these problems we could solve with better technology if we just better identify the problem? So we're analyzing that. We did a survey earlier this year, got over 1,000 advisors to do a really in-depth survey on their financial planning process. And we'll be publishing a bunch of research around best practices in the actual financial planning process and how to do it more efficiently and save time. Yeah. So that's our big focus right now is how do we better study the advisor community just to get a better understanding of what are we really doing? What are best practices? How can we be more successful advisors? And you know, if we find any other gaps where we need a solution and no one has a solution, we might make that one too.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for all of the great work that you've done for financial services professionals. You know, we are still, unfortunately, somewhat of a pariah when it comes to professions. And it's nice that people like you and all of your organizations and your network are looking out for financial services professionals because, you know, as you know better than anybody, this is a tough road to hoe, man. I mean, it's tough. Yeah. This is, you know, people trust you with their life savings and it's very stressful. And, you know, as a person who's a trained therapist and life coach, you know, I used to deal with that more than anything with my clients because a lot of people don't realize how stressful it is. And coming up with the solutions and the research that you're doing, I think is making our industry better. So, Michael, thank you very much for all that, man.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And so we're going to make sure that we have links to every single solitary thing that you talked about in our show notes today. But if you could give one piece of marketing advice to our listener audience, our community, what would it be?
I think my one piece of marketing advice is just figure out the one type of clientele you want to go after and just go after them. Yeah. You don't worry about all the people you're going to upset or all the people you're going to piss off along the way. Just find your voice and who you want to work with and work with those people. Most of us can have wildly successful advisory firms with 50 great clients. Mm-hmm. It's all it takes. Like I know advisors that have 200, 300, and 400, but the 80-20 rule applies and 80% of their profits come from 20% of their clients. So just focus on your top 20%. Most of us can have wonderfully successful practices with 50 great clients. So if all you need is 50, what can you do to get to those 50 ideal clients as quickly as possible? And don't worry about what other people think in the process. As long as you get the 50 people that want to work with you and find value in what you do, that's what it takes to have a great business.
And with that, thank you for being a guest on our 100th episode, Mr. Michael Kitsis. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And if you have not somehow subscribed to our podcast, make sure you click that subscribe now button below. That way, every time we come out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. And make sure that you go to kitsis.com and make sure that you subscribe to Michael's podcast. Really great, amazing deep dives on some stuff that, well, really our entire listenership could probably spend a lot more time on. So this has been 100th episode. We have we never thought we were going to get to where we are right now, and we couldn't have done it without all of you. So we want to thank all of you very much and all of the guests that we've had on the podcast so far. If you haven't listened to some of the older ones, go back and laugh at us because some of them were really bad. But I think we've really dialed it in and we're having a really great time. So with all of that, for everybody with all of the stuff that Michael Kitsis does, the Nerd Eye View, XY Planning Network, Advice Pay, and partner and director of wealth management at the Pinnacle Advisory Group, this is Matt Halloran. And for everybody at Top Advisor Marketing, we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
Are you ready to change the way you communicate with your clients? Are you tired of being the best kept secret in your area? Learn how to become a prolific online influencer, attract more ideal clients, and grow your business. Contact us today and see what the power of podcasting can do for your business. Click on the Contact Us link on our website at topadvisormarketing.com and set up a call to learn more. Follow us on LinkedIn and Facebook for more updates and information.